As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Romesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Welcome to The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. I'm Will Kelleher and you're listening to our special series examining just what it takes to win the Rugby World Cup in the company of those who have been there and done it. We'll take you from 1987 to 2019 through the eyes of great world champions ahead of the 10th World Cup in France this autumn. We'll hear their memories and stories, anecdotes and insight, all with the goal of answering one simple but devilish question. How do you win the World Cup? So join us on a rugby journey to whet your appetite for France with Legends of the Game. This time on How to Win the World Cup, the Boks are back in town with their second victory in 2007. We're under Rihanna's umbrella all summer as the new Wembley Stadium opens and the smoking ban comes in across the UK. In rugby, South Africa are by no means favourites going into the French World Cup. The year before, Australia beat them 49-0 in Brisbane, but by 2007, they're an improving force under coach Jake White and the assistant he brings in, Eddie Jones. At the tournament, Brian Habana scores 8 times in 7 tests as the Boks blast England 36-0 in the pool and go through Fiji and Argentina in the knockouts before facing the English again in the final. In a penalty fest, they get the job done, much to Mark Kwaito's dismay, and John Smith lifts the World Cup in Paris. In the midst of it all was scrum half Farida Priya. So from the Times and the Sunday Times, this is a Ruck special, How to Win the World Cup with Farida Priya. Okay, Furry, a pleasure to have you on the pod. Now, look, we're asking everyone this first easy question. How do you win the World Cup, Furry de Pria?
Thank you very much, Will. Nice joining you guys. We won it. France beat New Zealand. France got beaten by England. England wasn't the greatest team going into the finals. I think the players took a bit of a leading role there and they made it into the final. And we had a great squad, we had great players and we had a great management team. But to win a World Cup, a lot of things must go your way. So luckily in 07, a lot of things went our way.
Yeah, okay. So the idea is that we'll try and come up with some sort of blueprint or answer by the end of our chat. But why don't we take our listeners into the build-up to 2007? Get back in your time traveling machine. Tell me what the build up was like for you guys, where the Boks were traveling at the time. I mean, I was looking back and a year before that 49-0 defeat to Australia must have been pretty harrowing. So it wasn't like other World Cups.
100%. Our journey probably started in 04. The Boks had a terrible sort of lead up to the 2003 World Cup, a lot of old guys. And so we had a fresh start, new coach. a lot of young guys that played in the 99 under 21 World Cup and the 2002 under 21 World Cup, which we won. And Jake was actually the coach in 202. So a lot of those guys got together. And so it was sort of a new start, a new system. And we sort of built it from 04. Obviously, 06 didn't go as planned. Jake was almost fired at the end of your tour. And so we just got together in 07. We had great Super Rugby, which were Bulls and the Sharks in the final. And that sort of gave us a lot of confidence going into the World Cup. And we knew exactly where the starting 15 was. And that sort of, I would say, different than other teams. The bench wasn't really used. So it was a starting 15 that knew they were the best guys. And that played all the main games.
I'm trying to think. Everyone else has got a sort of different journey to how they complete it and win the World Cup. But for you guys, that 06 defeat, I don't want to bring up so many bad memories. We'll get to the good ones in a bit. But was that one of those where you thought, right, that's never happening again? Draw a line in the sand, move on. The only way is up type thing.
Yeah, well I think in that game, just talking 9-10, I think Ricky January started with Jaco van der Westhuizen and obviously in 07, myself and Butch started. So we started the next game against New Zealand, and that was sort of the start of a partnership with a halfback pairing that won it. So the team wasn't settled in 06. I think Jake wasn't sure who was the best guy. And it was almost like still testing things out. A few guys were left out end of year tour to sort of, let's call it, rest. And that made a big difference for the guys going to the Super Rugby and then into the World Cup.
Yeah, so when did you start thinking you were turning a corner then? Because looking into 07, you thrashed England twice when they came down, didn't you? Was that the moment where you started to sort of think, right, okay, we're building something here? I mean, those 55-22, 58-10 were big results against England, weren't they?
Yeah, 100%. I think it wasn't England's best team as well, but... like I said, when we got together the day after the Super Rugby final, and then it was obviously the Bulls and the Sharks, majority of the team, and we got together and said, look, okay, we've got massive provincial rivals in SA, and they said, we put that behind us, but it will give us massive confidence going into the World Cup. And I think for those two teams, and with John as the captain, it was sort of, once we got together and said, look, we're gonna win this thing. We know we've got the players. We had 3 years before, which we had highs and lows. Yeah, so we were very confident going into the World Cup.
Yeah, so was there a special meeting then? Did you all, I mean, they've talked about that in teams in the past, haven't they? You've got to almost put your club rivalries aside. Did you all, I don't know.
100%, because emotions was very high. And it was sort of, that final was sort of, at that stage, I'd call it the second biggest game in SA. Obviously, the 95 final would have been a bit, but that was the second biggest game win. We never thought the SA team would win Super Rugby. It was just, earlier days was just too hard. And then to have our own final of two teams. And then, yeah, getting into that team room, next driving together from Durban to Bloemfontein, getting together in Bloemfontein, I said, look, that's behind us. Great work, everyone. Let's win this World Cup.
Yeah, yeah. Because obviously in the Tri-Nations, you guys came third, didn't you? So I suppose, like other World Cups at that time, maybe New Zealand down your way particularly were the favoured Southern Hemisphere team. But by the time the World Cup came around, you were a different beast. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, 100%. And I think just Jake's plan was, at that stage, we played just so much rugby and played every single Super Rugby game, every single incoming to a Tri-Nations end of year Carrie Cup. So that Tri-Nations, he sort of left 20 guys behind. In Cape Town, we had 2 weeks there to sort of sort out all the nitty-gritty things and sort of the way we want to go forward. And I think that helped massively.
So tell me about Jake White then. I mean, he'd started a fuse before 2004. And I think I've heard a story of around 2004 when he started, one of his first meetings, he said, guys, we're going to win the 2007 World Cup. And quite a lot of players went, come on, mate, it's not April Fool's Day. Was it about instilling belief right from the start, despite some of the results?
Yeah, I think so. It's exactly that same. We got to get in 2004 before the Ireland series. I actually made my debut the first test as well. So, yeah, it was that same team room which we had in 06 in Bloemfontein. He just got together and said, look, 2003 was a disaster. Everything before it was a disaster. We've got the players to win it. Like I said, for 99, 02, one of 21 guys, they had to beat New Zealand and Australia winning those World Cups. And then bringing back guys like Os and Monty, sort of older guys. And the team evolved from there. But that belief was installed in 04. And then we won the Tri-Nations in 04. So we knew we were good enough. But Jake, I think what also really helped after that, 20 guys that stayed behind in SA. And then we had a month after the Tri-Nations, which we got Eddie Jones involved, which obviously, from my view, helped us tremendously winning the World Cup. Just getting someone from outside. He coached against us, and he knew exactly where our strengths would be. And he sort of installed that belief as well, hearing from a ground, sort of from the outside. And Jake trusted him, and we had a great relationship with him.
Yeah, I'd love to know more about the dynamic between Jake White and Eddie Jones. I mean, two big egotistical lads there, aren't they? I mean, how did it kind of play out? I mean, Eddie he was at a bit of a different point in his career at that point, wasn't he? But how did that all work for you guys?
So that first 2 weeks, Rassie Erasmus was actually sort of a guy that Jake got in from the outside in. And after those 2 weeks, he got the Stormers job, and he said, "Look, he can't do it." So Jake called in a few of the senior players, said he wants to get Eddie involved, and I remember John and Victor and all of us just said, "Yeah, that would be amazing." So it obviously worked out perfectly, and the thing is that a World Cup, the head coach takes so much pressure. So he had all that pressure, but John could almost keep him a little bit away from the team. And Eddie had zero pressure, so he could just coach us. The dynamics between the players and Eddie was fantastic. And then Jake would back whatever Eddie said, because he had to deal with all the other pressures. So that dynamics worked out perfectly. And also we had a great coaching team with Gert Smal and Alistair Kutse as well, which became head coaches in their own right. So that whole management team and the dynamics worked out perfectly.
Yeah. So many players that Eddie Jones has coached over the years have got their story of when they first met him and the meeting. What was yours? Was he showing you clips and saying you were terrible, or was he picking you up? How did he treat you first up?
No, luckily he was treating me very well, and so we struck up a great relationship, and so I'm still a big fan. That's where I went to Japan to sort of go to his club and just sort of we had and even when he went to coach for the national team, I'd lunch with him once a week, so I'm still keeping in touch. So we just struck up really well, and I just really enjoyed his sort of style, and he's always expecting the best out of everyone, and that's just the same as me. You want excellence in your own one, guys. You want to win, so everyone must pull their weight.
Yeah. What's lunch with Eddie Jones like? He likes a glass of Malbec.
Well, 99% of the time, we're just talking rugby. So, but lunch in Tokyo once a week was great fun, and it was just sort of picking my brain, picking his brain, and sort of trying to make everything better.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think I've read too that he was showing you guys videos of some of the Brumbies and the Australians and saying, like, this is how you can attack, find space. Was there anything that you took into your game that you didn't think about before?
What I really enjoyed is he understood the SA way, and he just sort of brought that flavor of let's make it 10% better and just a little bit better line here, forward with a better angle there. And he just sort of brought that detail to play, which we never had. And it was quite simple. So it was really nice and hearing from him and sort of him backing our way as well.
I'd love to talk to you too about the French World Cup. I mean, obviously, we're in the midst of a French World Cup now. They hosted it in 2007 when you were there. So tell me about the sort of sights and sounds of that. And what do you remember about sort of being around the tournament itself? Did you get any sort of downtime, or were you kind of so focused on the rugby you didn't get out much, or how did it play out?
Yeah, luckily we usually on Thursdays, if we would play the Saturday, Thursdays was off day, so you usually had a massive golf game on Thursdays, which we enjoyed and we loved. Until the semi-final time, then Jake started stressing and we weren't allowed to go and play. So myself, Spalk Berger, Donner, and Victor Matfield snuck out and went to play our usual game. And Luckily, we beat them, and actually heard Jay go about it, and wasn't very happy. But all four of us had great semifinals. But that's the problem with coaches. They just stress too much at a World Cup. They do things differently, and it worked. It worked all 4 years. We did it the same way, and then you get to a semifinal, and he said, "No, we're not allowed to go." So we decided, no, we'd rather keep to our things that we want to do. No, so the World Cup was fantastic. Yes, just obviously in South Africa, everything's not always working here, government-wise, and let's call it whatever. So it's great. That was fantastic with the trains, and was perfectly, everything was managed so well. So, and so many good people around us there. And so we really enjoyed it all. And we were most of the time in Paris. We took play in Montpellier one game in that quarterfinal in Marseille, which was very hot. But the weather was great. So everything was great. The only time it became cold was the week of a final, and it sort of changed in a week.
Yeah, good weather for golf. Where was the secret golf trip?
It was actually at Disney. Disney's got a Euro Disney's got a golf course there.
At the Disney. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
In 2019, the box stayed at Disneyland in Tokyo.
So yeah.
I don't know. There's a little thing in there. Maybe a portent. Stay at Disney and you'll win the World Cup.
Yeah. Myself, I'm hating Disney, so I don't know why it worked for us, but I'm a golf coach.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
So let's go on to the tournament then. I mean, our English listeners will remember a lot of reasons for that World Cup, but maybe for the harrowing one at the start, the 36-0. Was there a massive focus from you guys on winning that second game for you and making a statement early on? Because that basically battered England's confidence and everything, and they completely ripped up everything after that.
All the teams have got different stories, but Jake's... He had a massive focus on that game pre-World Cup. So if you ask me, I think your focus should be just on the first game and then take it from there. But his focus was always that England game and playing with defending world champions. So we were obviously psyched up for that game, and a lot of focus and effort was put into that game. But our first game against Samoa was a tough. That first half an hour was very tough, and there's two Ligi brothers running over us, and it was very physical and very tough. But then getting through that, we actually had a bit of confidence, and ready for the England game. And I'll never forget that game. It was just our first game in Stade de France. We were fortunate enough to go and watch the opening game between Argentina and France, which was, the atmosphere was just fantastic. So we sort of soaked in that atmosphere going to that England game. And it was just a great game.
So was Jake sort of drilling in over a number of months or longer about that England one when you knew that you had them in the pool?
Once the draw came out, he just always put in some nuggets of that England game, defending world champion. So it was always in the back of my mind. And then getting into that, let's call it the Monday before the game, now it's there. Now you're in this world. In this game, we've worked hard. We've talked about, let's call it 2 years about this game or a year and a half about this game. And we put a lot of pressure into the game, almost like a final atmosphere in itself.
And at that point too, once you'd beaten him 36-0, did you shock yourselves almost at nilling England at a World Cup? That doesn't happen much. Like, such a convincing victory.
Yeah, it's just one of those, let's call it professional games, which our defense was unbelievable. Our tactical play was great. And we had three opportunities to score, which we took. So we took a lot of confidence out of that. After that game, we knew, look, we're obviously good enough to win this World Cup, but if we can keep performances like this, we'll in for a chance. And then seven days later, we almost lost against Tonga. So this game keeps your feet grounded as well. So
yeah, I wonder whether that's one of the sort of, I don't know, first lessons from your win of, you can't get too far ahead of yourself because there's always another team around the corner ready. Because, as you say, 30-25, a little scare against Tonga. And then because you'd beaten England, you had possibly an easier route to the final. But the Fiji game was crazy, that quarter final, wasn't it? They were tearing you up to start with. Is that the lesson? There are banana skins out there that you might not think of before?
I remember the Friday night in Marseille, we were watching the New Zealand game. And obviously they lost, and I think Australia lost just after them or before them. And we were very shocked at it. And once that happened, we knew, look, the road to winning this World Cup just became so much easier. And then standing behind the poles, I think it was 20-all with 20 minutes to go, I was thinking, yo, the Tri-Nations teams are going, it's out of this World Cup. And there was just a switch from John. And they got 14 two quick tries and put us under pressure and in the heat, and the crowd was going mad. And so just to get out of that game, it was sort of a great relief. And now we're playing Argentina the following week, which Argentina is always difficult, and it's a great team, but it's not like you have to play New Zealand or France in France or even Australia. So we knew that we've got a great route going into the final.
I suppose the Argentina thing was, as you mentioned it a while back, they won that first game, didn't they? They beat the host France and ended up coming third in the tournament, and it was their best ever
competition. Yeah, they had a fantastic team, and Augustin Bouchard, the captain, I was playing against him. He was a great leader. That was a great fly off, and Anders probably the best team at that World Cup. So a lot of things were going their way, but I think we were on conference with relief beating Fiji, knowing, look, we're going to play again at the start of France, great stadium. Last time we played there was England. So just doing what, if we do what we do well, there's no way they will be able to beat us.
Everyone always says that you need sort of four or five, maybe more world-class players, world 15 players to win the World Cup. And you had plenty across your side. I'd love to ask you about Brian Abana, because he obviously scored 8 tries in that tournament and was kind of the poster boy for maybe everyone in South Africa and outside of it too. Did you see his sort of, I don't know, star growing throughout that tournament? I know he'd been in the team for a while, but with his pace and running against the cheetah and all that stuff that came around it, it was a bit different, wasn't it, with Brian?
Yeah, no, it was. With him and JP Peterson, we had two fantastic wingers that could score a lot of tries, and obviously Brian against Samoa started off pretty well. I think he scored 4 tries.
Yeah, 4. Yeah.
Yeah, 4. So it's quite a boost going to get to the target. No, and then he was just fantastic. And I think the partnership with JP and the steadiness of Percy at the back, and then obviously a jog free on the sort of inside, which was great. So it was a good team for us, and it was a team that loved playing together and loved the way we played.
So take me into the week of the final then. Is the secret golf trip back on? Are you allowed to go and play having won the semi, or is that cancelled on the Thursday again?
So I think I mentioned Jake found out about it, but looking back, I think we actually that night of the course after the semi-final, We had a little beer with him and said, look, we're gonna 100% play golf this week of the final. And we were back at Disneyland that following week.
So
same four balls, same everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. You can't break the tradition. No. Talk me through then the psychology of playing a team you've already beaten in the tournament in a final. I mean, New Zealand ended up doing it the time after you in 2011, didn't they, with France? So is it a difficult one to think through yourselves because you think we've just smashed them early in the pool, but they're a different side now? How do you kind of work that out in your heads? Do you have to just focus on it as a completely separate game?
Yeah, it's a tough one because you've got so much confidence knowing. Just with self-belief, we had, you know, we thought we were a better team than them. So just doing what we do well, and if we've got a, we sort of don't make silly mistakes and play outside of character, we should be able to beat them. But it's a World Cup final, and a lot of things can go. So it was a stress. It was the first time, the only time I think in my life, which I stressed a bit going into a game. Just because I knew we were better than them, or we thought we were better than them, and so it's actually for us to lose the game. And we kept it pretty tight in the game, and obviously there was one or two big moments in the game which came out sort of our way. But yeah, there was not a moment in the game. It's honestly not arrogant. There was not a moment in the game which we thought we would lose that game. We were just so much full of confidence. And I think if we had to make it a little bit more open, we would have been able to do it.
So I remember reading about Martin Johnson in 2003. He felt so under pressure for certain of those games. He started doing things that he'd never done in the years before and would go and visit the stadium beforehand and things like that. Did you do anything different on the morning of the game? Because these French kickoffs are so late, aren't they? You've got all day to wait for the World Cup final. I wonder, were you walking around Disneyland or something to just take your mind off it?
Yeah, no, so it's the first time I sort of felt pressure because I actually felt a moment, the heaviness of the vocation. I was in 95, I was 13 years old and I was able to be at the game, at the stadium, and I'll never forget that sort of 80 minutes or plane flying over and whatever, and just sort of a moment. So that sort of got to me a bit. But yeah, I was always just trying to keep things the same, exactly the same. But as SA would be, we got a phone call the morning of the final, I'd say at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, and then the president is there, he wants to greet us. So that sort of changed it. We've never done that before. So, luckily, and we had to get in our number ones, 10 o'clock the morning of the final. But In SA, anything is possible. So that was different.
Yeah, you can't say no to the president, can you? Sorry, mate, we've got a World Cup final to win. So tell me about the game itself. I think you're Captain John Smith, since called it one of the worst games of rugby I've ever played. But was that almost not really part of the plan, but maybe a manifestation of the nerves that you guys were feeling or the weight of history, thinking about 95, perhaps, that it wasn't quite the sort of, I don't know, celebration of rugby it could have been? It was quite a tight, tense World Cup final, wasn't it?
It wasn't by design. It was the sort of game we played, but we kept it a little bit tighter than usual. And England was actually very good on defense, and with Johnny Wilkins, he didn't play the previous game. Obviously, with his experience, and so it was a tough game to play. But we would have been rugby wise better to play a more running sort of type of game. It just England didn't leave it open for us to play that way. So we had to grind it out.
So all of my English listeners now saying, ask him about Mark Cueto and the try that wasn't a try. So you're allowed to be honest now. All these years on, do you think it was a try for Ida Prayer?
100% was not a try.
Not a try, okay.
But even if it was, England got a penalty, so they got 3 points. So it's a 4-point game.
Yeah,
so,
true.
Yeah, so I still can't do the math that even if it was a try, I'm not sure how they would have beaten us. So it was just a 4-point decision.
Yeah, it was 15-6 in the end. So you still won convincingly, yeah.
But let's for your listeners' sake, yes, 100% try, Johnny kicks it over, 15-10, pretty much the same thing.
Yeah, true, true. Do you remember the agony of watching that? Because I was looking at, before we came on, I was watching that TMO decision that's still on YouTube. It takes forever. You must have been looking at the screen going like, oh my God, is this a try or not?
Yeah. Now, look, it was obviously a 50-50 call. And I remember just standing at, like, in that moment, we still, even if they give a try, we actually had no stress of going back and still winning the game. So I just remember the confidence of the guys. Like, try, it's no issue. We just go, we know in ourselves we're better. And if we have to change one or two things, we'll do that. But yeah, no issues.
So the other bit on the clip of the World Cup final highlights is that you're the man who actually kicks the ball out to end it, which must be a fun thing to have in your back pocket, that you've had that moment where you know that you're going to win the World Cup. You've got it at the back of a ruck and then you just boot it out, and that's it. Talk me through the emotions of that.
I think we had a scrum and it was like 2 minutes to go, but obviously leading by more than seven, there's no chance you can lose. So it's just actually a nice sort of moment, two or three phases, and now you're going to kick it out, going to win it. So just that moment was fantastic. But Brian, as I kicked it out, he ran into the stadium and he went to get that ball. So he still got that ball, which I kicked out, and he put it underneath his jersey. So that was the first thing he was thinking about, is getting that World Cup final ball, which you kicked out.
Did he shout at you, come on, mate, don't kick it too far, I need to go and get that?
Yeah, a little. In the change room, in the change room, the first time I saw it, he had the ball. He said, no, that's one he went to get and fit. He went to fetch it. So that was what he was thinking about.
That's just great. So as the boy who would have watched Francois Pienaar lift the World Cup, Nelson Mandela, the jumbo coming over Ellis Park, all that, was it immediately the emotions hit you that you had done what your heroes had done and you'd won the World Cup? Or did it take some time to filter in when you were sitting having a beer in the changing room or in a Parisian nightclub later that night or something?
It was just sort of emotional. It was hard work getting there, but it was just a fantastic, fantastic feeling. And I think only later on you realize, back it's massive, but 11 or 15, we could have won it. So I was, after 2015, I realized that if you can't be defined by a ref's call or a mistake here or mistake there. And we were good enough to win it the other two times as well. We didn't. We were not lucky. We were obviously, seven things went our way. So that was fantastic. So very fortunate to be part of a team that won the World Cup. But as many players that hasn't won it, that's probably been as good as to win it. So yeah, it was fantastic to be part of it. But it's, at the end of the day, it's just sport. And love watching it now. But it's going to be a very interesting one.
Well, that's the thing, I suppose, maybe more so than, and I don't know whether we make more of this outside South Africa than you guys do in South Africa, but it seems like with the South African World Cup wins, there's this sort of lots of talk about the higher purpose and what it means for the country and sort of uniting the nation. Was there a sense of that in 2007, or was that maybe a bit more unique to 95 and 2019? I don't know. How did you feel about that side of it?
Yeah, I think we sort of try and use it every World Cup, and every World Cup is about uniting. And but at the end of the day, it's just a Springbok team that actually just want to win. And obviously, if that means uniting a country, fantastic. But that's not the reason that you play the game. You play the game because you want to play it with your mates. You want to be the best that you can be, and you want to put yourself under pressure. And uniting the nation, if that's a benefit, that's fantastic. And obviously, seven, it was getting back to SA. We didn't experience vibe in France, but once we landed in SA, we couldn't believe what was happening. And that's just unbelievable.
Yeah, talk me through those scenes. So were you coming a little bit hungover on the jumbo jet, and you arrive, and was the airport packed out in Joburg? What? Tell me how it all went.
Yeah. So we had to fly via London, because BA at that stage was our sponsor. So we flew out of London, and as we arrived, it was just madness and thousands and thousands of people. And obviously, we knew winning the World Cup was big, but was just crazy, and that week on the bus was just crazy. Yeah, it was fantastic.
Right, so we've got to get to the end of our where we started. How did you win the World Cup? So we've talked through a few things. We've talked about building as kids, great coaching, superstitions, the golf. What's on your list of things that you need to tick off if you're to win it?
Yeah, at least five world class players, consistency, and the bounce of the ball. Great coaching stuff.
Easy as that.
Easy.
If you get all that in place, you've done it.
No red cards in the first 20 minutes.
Yeah, that's maybe more relevant. Oh,
first half. Let's call it no red cards in the first half.
Well, look, Fury, amazing. Thanks so much for joining us on this look back at 2007. And you'll always have the glory of those days. And I know you've had your other World Cups, but at least you can always say I'm a world champion and you've done it. So great pleasure to talk it all through with you and enjoy, keep enjoying this tournament because it's going to be great fun, isn't it?
Yeah. Thank you very much, Will, and great talking to you and great looking back into my memories. South Africa, calling
you. South Africa, calling.
The train is now approaching junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.